It's the confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. For many in our region, food is everywhere, at supermarkets, corner groceries, on street corners, and restaurants aplenty, but for thousands of others, access to food is a daily challenge. And some Pennsylvania landowners say they're getting ripped off by natural gas companies leasing their land. That's coming up. But first, and the winner is seemingly, probably, Democrat Connor Lamb. But Republican Rick Saccone has not conceded.
You never gave up on us. You never gave up on me. And I thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
If it were a foot race, it would have been a photo finish. The special election in Pennsylvania's 18th congressional district came down to counting absentee ballots and more. Democrat Connor Lamb squeaked out a win over Republican Rick Saccone by just hundreds of votes. Was it a referendum on President Trump? We're going to discuss the local and national implications of this race for a district that's been redrawn in time for the May primary. With Chris Potter, who covers politics and government for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, Wes Van Teicher, reporter for the Pittsburgh Tribune Review, Unley Herring, WESA reporter covering government and politics, and on the line from Washington, NPR congressional reporter Scott Detrow. Welcome to you all.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Hey, thanks.
Your questions and comments are welcome, and tweet them. Use the hashtag, please, WESAConfluence. So to each of you, on a scale of 1 to 10, with 10 being extremely surprised, how surprised are you by Connor Lamb's victory? Scott?
I'm going to go with a 7. Certainly the results themselves were very surprising. This is not a district that should have been competitive, but there were a lot of signs leading up to Election Day that indicated the Democrats were more energized, Lamb was catching on as a candidate, and that Saccone was falling a little flat. So because of that, I'll go 7 and not totally shocking 10, because we saw some signs that could happen.
Okay, Onley, 1 to 10.
I'm going to go with a 4, and the reason for that is that, like Scott said, Connor Lamb really had momentum on his side, and that was reflected in the polls. Leading up to Election Day, things were really trending in his direction there. But having covered this race since the nominating conventions in November and attending various events each of the candidates held, you saw much bigger turnout at events for Connor Lamb than for Rick Saccone. And to me, that was just a really strong sign that things were going well for him and they were serious and organized.
Wes Van Teicher.
I'll go ahead and jump in with an 8. Just going back to, like Anlie said, the very beginning of this, when everyone just thought that the Democrat didn't have a chance, when Saccone was down by like 12 points in the polling, the gap really closed. And so it was still a surprise election night that Connor Lamb pulled this out.
Chris Potter.
I'm going to go with pie, 3.14159, because it was pie week this week. And also because I think a little bit like Anlie said, I think there were a lot of indications. Polling obviously showed this race within the margin of error. There was clearly a lot more enthusiasm and energy on the Democratic side. There's more of a ground game. I mean, in some ways, it's kind of a telling irony that it came down to the absentee vote, because there was a bit more of a sense. This is the kind of stuff when you have a good, solid, on-the-ground campaign, you're paying attention to stuff like absentee ballots and making sure your union members and other folks are able to vote. So I wasn't terribly surprised by it. There's probably a joke in there somewhere, because I use pie, about sort of this race coming full circle, because we're about to go into another election where some of the candidates who made a run at this the first time are about to make a run going forward into the May primary.
And we'll get into that a little bit later. You were all out stopping by various polling places. I'm going to get your thoughts about what you heard from voters. Scott, what did you want to find out from District 18 voters? Because you were in town for NPR covering this race.
Yeah, I think from our perspective, what I was curious about is what can we take from this special election to give us any clues about November and how things will go when the entire House of Representatives is up for election. And I think, Kevin, you and I were talking in the newsroom before the vote that it's always tricky to take too many takeaways from one particular race. But if you look at this within the context of other special elections that have happened, the statewide races in New Jersey and Virginia, you're seeing a lot of things happen over and over again. Voters in the suburbs are going to Democratic candidates. You have places And you saw this again in some of the Pittsburgh suburbs, the Allegheny County higher income towns, the townships that voted for Connor Lamb that have traditionally gone Republican. That is alarming a lot of Republican political consultants in Pennsylvania. You're seeing higher Democratic enthusiasm. You're seeing that in the turnout numbers. And also, most interestingly, in those absentee ballots that really decided the race late in the night Tuesday, take the fact that Washington County, as a county as a whole, went for Rick Saccone. But when you looked at those absentee ballots, Connor Lamb got more votes from the absentee ballots. That's because Democrats were motivated to get their ballots in, energized to get their ballots in, more than Republicans. And I think all of that is adding up to a lot of signs that Democrats are more excited to vote in the midterms. And that could be a big problem for Republicans.
Yeah, and I'll just add to something Scott said. I mean, the best example of what he's talking about with the suburban vote is Upper St. Clair. This is, as people in the listening area know, staunchly Republican, very affluent district, but also very, very college educated. It's a community that Donald Trump struggled with himself a little bit. There were actually precincts that Donald Trump lost in 2016. And I think that reflects some softness in how sort of college educated folks have looked at the president. And although Mr. Saccone has a couple of postgraduate degrees, I think he kind of rubbed them in exactly that same kind of wrong way. So what you had was Connor Lamb, a Democrat, winning some voting districts in Upper St. Clair by 20 percentage points. I don't think that's something like that is probably not. I grew up in Upper St. Clair. Something like that has probably not happened in my lifetime. It is a generational kind of thing. And Scott's quite right. There are there's a guy, Mark Harris, who is a Republican consultant in Pittsburgh, who was tweeting that night, just this is apocalyptic for Republicans. Had this been a statewide race, imagine a Lou Barletta, who now Senator Bob Casey has already said Lou Barletta is
from the Luzerne County.
Yes, a congressman from Luzerne County who's running for Senate against Bob Casey is likely to be the Republican nominee. You know, Bob Casey calling him, Lou Barletta is the Senate's answer to Rick Saccone here. And there's a lot of concern about how this stuff plays and what it means going forward. And Scott is quite correct that we saw the same kind of thing in Virginia. And if Republicans don't do something soon, they're going to see it elsewhere.
Anlie?
When I went to the polls, the officials there were noting that turnout was higher than they expected, and that goes again to this motivation point. And at one of the polling places I visited in North Strabane, there at one point was a line out the door because one of the computers for checking people in had broken, so there was a backup with that. And I got there right after things were up and running again and the line was much shorter. And there were some voters there who had actually come back after leaving because they thought the line was too long earlier. And that just goes again to the point of how motivated people were to cast their vote in this election.
Wes?
Yeah. There were all these people out there voting, higher than average turnout. Some of them were saying that they were surprised by how much they were seeing this race in their daily lives, like yard signs everywhere. They're seeing ads all the time. Even we talked with a Republican voter who voted for Connor Lamb, said he was just fed up with all the negative advertising. And, you know, you had outside groups spending a lot of money on those negative ads for Saccone. But for voters who are sitting at home thinking about who they're going to vote for, they still are going to likely say that maybe Saccone is behind this. It might have affected their votes, this negative ads.
So I want to ask, so we have a national perspective, Scott in Washington. We got our local political reporters here in studio. Was this race, one of 435 House seats, was it really worth all the national attention? We'll start with Scott from the national perspective.
I hope so. Otherwise, I wasted a couple weeks of my life. You know, it's always worth checking in on these races that happen one at a time. It got way more attention than any House race will this fall. It got way more money spent than any House race will this fall. I think there's probably more money spent in this particular House race than there will be in a lot of Senate campaigns. And often, is it worth it or not? It's not like this one seat is going to make a difference on any votes in the House of Representatives. It's not like that Alabama Senate special election that got the margin in the Senate to within just one senator. But the money is spent and the attention is paid because it's all relative, right? This is the only game in town, so everyone's focusing on it, and especially the national parties, the outside groups that dumped all this money in, they're viewing this as a test run for the fall and a referendum on President Trump, even though Connor Lamb's campaign tried as hard as it could to say, not a referendum on President Trump. It's a local race between these two candidates.
Yeah, I mean, I think that was the big dynamic of this race, I think, is you had two very different races. You had Rick Saccone and the Republicans, largely, I think, because of where the money came from, running sort of a very national kind of race, and Connor Lamb doing the opposite. I mean, right up until the Monday before the election, you had this tells you everything in a way. You had Connor Lamb, much to the frustration of many reporters, making phone calls and doing some door knocking with voters identified as undecided still. He was reaching out on a one-by-one basis. Conversely, on the Republican side, you had Rick Saccone appearing with Donald Trump Jr. at Sarah's Candy with a lot of national press there, showing up in hairnets, which I think kind of sums up the problems that campaign really had. Somebody needs to be like, when you're doing something like this, there needs to be an advanced person who's like, will we have to wear hairnets here? And if the answer is yes, you find somewhere else to go. And I think it just speaks of this sort of they were just the gang that couldn't shoot straight, I think, on the Republican side. But yeah, I mean, I think that's the lesson here may be the national implication here may be A, it's very unclear to me whether the national messaging that was deployed in this race, which is tax cuts are good, Connor Lamb and Nancy Pelosi bad. It's not clear that that message is particularly salient with voters. And conversely, I think Connor Lamb pointed to a way you can win races as a Democrat, even in territory that's not particularly friendly. And it's by trying to avoid the kind of debate that all us pundits want to have all the time.
Wes?
Yeah. Agree with a lot of what Chris is saying there. It's this national narrative was established pretty early on. I mean, these candidates were both selected in November. It was pretty quiet for a month or so after that. And then you started seeing this national stream of stories build and build and build until the last couple of weeks. It's been everywhere. And this narrative established of this has a big bellwether for the fall elections is out there. And these groups are spending lots of money to try to influence that narrative. It seems like that's what the big objective was for all the big spenders in this race, the groups at least.
I think there is something to that narrative. I was talking with a lot of the people who are active or were active with Connor Lamb's campaign, and a lot of them were women living in the suburbs south of Pittsburgh, places like Bethel Park, Upper St. Clair, Mount Lebanon. And for them, this was very much about sending a message to the president and the leadership in the GOP on Capitol Hill. And they'd been organizing well before this race was even something that was going to happen. They wanted to get former Congressman Tim Murphy, a Republican, out of office ever since President Trump was elected. So that was definitely a factor. Connor Lamb, though, was working with this district where you had a lot of people who supported President Trump. We all know the district went heavily for the president in 2016. So for him, it seems it was smart to, let's say, localize the race. That's the word that is being used, and focus on more economic issues such as infrastructure, tariffs, those kinds of things, and take not too leftist stance on gun control. Mm-hmm. So he really had this diverse coalition he had to meld together, but the national backdrop definitely was at play here.
You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. We're talking about this week's Pennsylvania 18 House race that is over, but it is not officially over because of provisional ballots still to be counted, but it seems that Connor Lamb is the victor. Speaking of Connor Lamb, although Rick Saccone has not conceded, Lamb did declare victory early Wednesday morning and talked about what he wanted to do.
I'll work on the problems our people face, secure their jobs and pensions, protect their family. And I will work with anyone to do that.
All right, we heard that Connor Lamb, according to some national pundits, was the perfect Democrat for this race, for this district. Young, former military, former prosecutor, moderate Democrat. Yet others opined that if this had been a primary, he might not have won because he might not have been liberal enough in his campaign. Connor Lamb called himself a Pennsylvania Democrat. Chris Potter, what does that mean, and has it changed over the years?
You know, I think what he was trying to say there was that he was a pro-labor guy on a lot of these economic issues when it comes to protecting Social Security or Medicare or these other kind of social safety net programs. He's going to be a strident voice for those. But some of the kind of social issues, abortion and guns in particular, he was not going to stake out a staunchly an ideological position. I think there's a lot of narrative going around in the part of Republicans to try to minimize what happened here. And part of that is saying, oh, if it had been a primary, he could not possibly have won. And there may be some legitimacy to that. On the other hand, he did pretty well with Democratic committee people who made him the nominee. And I'll say, too, that as much as he may have been the perfect candidate, a lot of the women, especially in the suburbs that Ann Lee was talking about, Connor Lamb was to the right of these women on guns, especially. And they got behind him, and they didn't just vote for him. They went out and knocked the hell out of doors in that district. And that's why you saw what you saw coming out of the suburbs there. So the idea that the Democratic electorate is just made up of these raving people who demand further and further left every time, I don't know that this race necessarily proves that.
Yeah, I just want to jump in there. Those groups did, I think, support Connor Lamb even before the official party made him their nominee. Groups like 412 Rise Up, indivisible groups that have formed since the 2016 election to try to influence local politics.
Anley?
It was my understanding that they did feel a little torn going into the nominating convention, but once Connor Lamb was chosen, they really embraced him. And I asked the women who I interviewed in these suburban areas how they felt about Connor Lamb's positions on things like gun control, abortion, the environment. And they all said they would prefer that he would have taken a more, they said, progressive stance on these things, but they were okay with the positions he ended up taking. They credited him for being honest mm-hmm. about where he stands yes. on these things. And for them, again, it was about sending that message to the GOP.
Scott Detrow, as NPR's a congressional reporter, were members talking much about this special election leading up to Tuesday, and maybe more importantly, since Tuesday?
Since Tuesday, definitely. You've had a lot of conversation about this, along a lot of the same things that we're talking about here. What does this mean? Can we take anything away from this in terms of the mood of the electorate, in terms of how Democrats should focus their campaigns? There's a little bit of a split take on the Democratic side. I mean, everyone's ecstatic on the Democratic side of the aisle that Connor Lamb was able to win. But I think there's a real split down the middle in terms of, does this mean Democrats should tack right? Does this mean that Lamb might have been too conservative in any other race? I'm not sure what the answer is there, but I think there's another trend that's been going on here. I mean, I've been focusing a lot of my coverage on the Democratic side, and especially after the 2016 presidential primary, there was a big question of, is the Democratic Party shifting to the left? Is that where the party has to go to get its voters to show up at the polls? And one of the three biggest upsets that we've seen, the three biggest Democratic victories that we've seen in the last year, it's Doug Jones in Alabama, it's Ralph Northam in Virginia, and it's Connor Lamb in Pennsylvania. All three of those candidates were pretty moderate, had some conservative views on a few issues, and still you saw Democratic grassroots voters making a point to show up to the polls. So I think that could be telling us something, that Democrats just want to beat Republicans, and they might fight it out in the primaries, but when it comes to Election Day, they're going to show up even if they don't agree with their candidates on all of the issues.
All right. We have just 3 minutes left. I want to get to a few more quick questions. Here in Pennsylvania, any incumbents or any challengers taking note of what transpired Tuesday? Chris?
Yeah, I mean, I think if you're Keith Raffis, you're thinking real careful about all this stuff. Connor Lamb will be redistricted into his district. If the state Supreme Court map holds up, he's got to be sweating bullets because the district he's in now is much friendlier than the one that to Democrats than the one Connor Lamb just won. Lou Barletta, too, as I said before, also really needs to be thinking about this stuff and what it means.
All right. I want to get to provisional ballots are being counted. Wes, Friday morning, you were down at the Allegheny County where they were swearing in people. Quickly, what is the process for counting provisional ballots?
Well, there were only, in Allegheny County at least, 40 provisional ballots that hadn't been added. They counted those up. 16 got challenged. Rick Saccone got a couple more votes than Connor Lamb. There were a there are more people observing than there were counting. There are a bunch of lawyers and observers down there from both campaigns and even from the U.S. House observing these elections, as it's just a very closely contested thing at this point.
Okay, so Connor Lamb's margin over Saccone was 627 votes. When you add in all the provisional ballots, even if they're all accepted, add in all the ballots that were sent out for military and overseas folks to send in, and they won't be due until, I believe, Tuesday, that would still leave, even if Rick Saccone got every single one of them, a margin of 9 votes for Connor Lamb. So quickly, in our last minute and a half, what is your final take? 20 seconds each. What is your final take on this election and going forward into the midterms? 20 seconds, Scott Detrow.
I think if Democrats could win this race, which they did, they could pick up 6 seats or more in Pennsylvania this fall, especially with the new Democratic-friendly maps.
On Lee, he gave you 25 seconds.
My take is, again, Democrats are very motivated, enthusiastic, energized, and they are not letting the perfect be the enemy of the good, and they want to win these races.
Wes Van Tischer.
I think one of the most interesting things is looking at the candidates that are coming out in addition to the excitement among voters. I think Democrats are seeing a bigger slate of candidates that helps them have a better shot at winning the bigger elections.
And 25 seconds for Chris Potter.
I think Republicans really ought to be concerned about how little effect their messaging had on this. I think a lot of Republicans are be thinking about whether Donald Trump is somebody you even want as a surrogate in this district. These guys are in some trouble.
Chris Potter covers politics and government for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. Wes Van Tischer is a reporter for the Pittsburgh Tribune-Review. On Lee Herring is a WESA reporter covering government and politics. And on the line from Washington, NPR congressional reporter Scott Detrow. Thanks to all of you.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Food is plentiful and easily obtained for most of us, but thousands in the region are challenged every day. Coming up, a joint project by WESA and Public Source on challenges to access to food. That's next on The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
Here's what's trending in Pittsburgh. I'm Sarah Kovash. The Pittsburgh Zoo gave its first preview of 4 baby otter pups this week. The pups were left undisturbed with their mother since being born in January and will soon be on display. And Pittsburgh-based company Duolingo, which offers online language courses, just launched a free Klingon course. That's right, the language made famous by Star Trek. It also offers a course in Valyrian, one of the fictional languages in Game of Thrones. Find more online at WESA.FM.
It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. For some in western Pennsylvania, food is ubiquitous. It's everywhere, at corner groceries, Giant Eagles, restaurants, on almost every corner. But for others, that's not the case. And even if they can get to these places, they may not be able to afford to buy what's inside. 90.5 WESA and the online news service Public Source partnered this week to look at the lack of access to food across our region. Joining us to discuss this multi-part series and what journalists have learned are Oliver Morrison, environment and health reporter for Public Source. Welcome, Oliver.
Thanks.
And Virginia Alvino Young, WESA's identity and justice reporter. Hi, Virginia.
Hi, Kevin. Thanks.
And also in studio is reporter Megan Harris. Welcome, Megan.
Hey, Kevin.
Let's start with the basic question. What is food insecurity, and how did your questions about its many manifestations, you know, really fuel your reporting? I'll start with you, Oliver.
So food insecurity is just this idea that some kids live in households where they don't know for sure that they're going to have 3 meals a day. And so what we were looking at is trying to see not only just what programs are around to help them and to provide assistance when these families may not be able to provide for themselves, but also just look at what is the healthiness of this food and what kind of habits are we building for them.
And I mean, a lot of service agencies extend that definition to include, you know, not just are people having access to eating three meals a day, but is it the type of access that enables a healthy life? So what types of things they're having access to, how often, you know, is it accessible, affordable, et cetera. So we looked into some programs that are helping, what is working and who is it helping and where, and also some of the barriers that disproportionately affect not just, you know, people in Pittsburgh, but the surrounding communities.
Yeah, a lot of those barriers lead to a lack of activity. It kind of fuels that debate we've been having about obesity and the causes for that. Another big part of that definition is from the USDA, which requires being able to fuel an active lifestyle.
Right. You know, we've heard in the last maybe decade the term food deserts, neighborhoods, communities without grocery stores, but often the reporting deals more with inner city neighborhoods. Virginia, what about food deserts in rural areas?
It's a whole different picture, right? Because even if the store is, you know, 5 miles away, which maybe wouldn't be as far in the city, right? Both would be considered food deserts.
Sure, well, short car ride away.
Right, okay. Well, if you don't have a car, if the weather is treacherous in a mountainous rural region, obviously there's a significant lack of public transportation in these areas. So when you start compounding all of these barriers, all of a sudden the same situation placed somewhere else is going to disproportionately affect that community.
Yeah, so one of the stories that we looked at was in Rankin. We found that there was a program trying to promote fresh vegetables in Rankin, which is considered a food desert. And so they found this guy, Carl Lewis, who was willing to try and introduce him in his community. And Carl was a fun guy. He has this big party every year where he brings about 200 people from the community to celebrate his dog's birthday. And so he started introducing vegetables on his dog's birthday and got people in the community to sign up and commit to buying these vegetables. And it's been a big hit. And the part of the way it works is that in addition to the residents committing to buy the produce, is that if they are eligible for food assistance, is that they get a little bit of extra money. So if they spend a dollar on something else in the store, they'll get a free dollar to spend on produce. So that's been a real boon for him.
Okay, so that's the Food Bucks program. Grants from the U.S. Department of Agriculture help fund those programs at various locations. Virginia, your story focused on Fayette County. So low income is definitely a factor, but something else you pointed out, around 16,000 families are eligible for SNAP, formerly food stamps. Only 10,000 families take advantage. Why?
Why? It's a big question, and it's something that we see in a lot of communities in general. That's more of an eligibility gap in rural communities across the country. You know, it's just, again, these compounding barriers. Okay, well, now you have food assistance. Well, if you don't have the resources to get yourself to the store, or even if you can get yourself to the store, if it's the stores that are actually in your community, they pretty much only provide like processed goods and not really a lot of fresh fruits and vegetables. And all of those things come at a higher cost than they would at, like, you know, your Pittsburgh neighborhood Giant Eagle, because they're being sourced in to these more rural, isolated areas. So a lot of it really does come down to poverty. And that's one of the challenges, is for people who are even just paying attention to the food issue, the access and the nutrition issue. If you're not addressing it holistically, if you're not looking at this person in every facet of their life, I mean, you kind of pull one thread and the sweater falls apart on that.
Yeah, and Allegheny County isn't significantly different. Depends on the measure you're looking at, what organization is taking the data, but probably between 14 to 16% of Allegheny County compared to that 18% in Fayette County are people in poverty, and they're having the same issue. The SNAP benefits are available and other benefits are available. A lot of it has to do with your geographic area in Pittsburgh. If you live in a particular zip code, you might qualify for this need. And if you go to that organization, they might be able to fulfill one or two problems that you have, but they may not be able to address a lot of the other underlying problems.
Well, one of the things I was thinking about too is that a lot of the times the food insecurity is happening more and more in communities that you don't necessarily think about as being communities in need. So I went up to North Hills Middle School, which largely considers itself like a pretty affluent suburb. And what we found there was that one of the biggest programs we know to help feed kids, the breakfast program, wasn't being utilized. So in the whole school, there were only 5 kids every day who were getting breakfast. All they had to do was take the breakfast out of the cafeteria, which was in sort of an inconvenient location. It wasn't where your friends are. You were in a rush trying to get to class. And they just had a cart, put it near the door as kids were getting in, and suddenly 50 kids were getting breakfast. And so in this place that maybe didn't always think of itself as a place that needed to provide and push for these children who might need a breakfast, You know, sometimes a simple solution could really make a big difference.
What's so interesting is comparing that more affluent area to Fayette County, which has a much higher poverty rate. I mean, there's also the matter of perception. They also don't, many residents perceive themselves to need assistance or to be people who would ever need assistance. So there's kind of this attitude of, you know, it's on us. You know, they're surrounded by people maybe of a similar low socioeconomic status. They are maybe prideful, which I think is something that I not only heard firsthand from people who, you know, say that they're not going to go to the food pantry. That's for people who really need it, even though they're, you know what I mean? Like, even though they're eligible for food assistance and that they don't have a lot in their pantry at home. Well, you know, that's for them. You know, if you just work hard, you can get ahead. And so there's this stigma.
Plus, it's just a really overwhelming thing sometimes to look at. A lot of the people we talk to, both from the organizational standpoint and the people on the ground who maybe need some of this assistance, it's a ton of paperwork. It's mm-hmm. a ton of proving that you are worthy of this assistance. And so many of the organizations, that's why you have this, you know, hundreds of groups that are reaching out, and two or three in particular that try their best to walk you through that paperwork, through that documentation, through that need to make sure that you can qualify for what you are legally enabled to have.
So while communities and families are trying to deal with the issue of food insecurity, local schools have also found different ways to deal with hunger. Oliver, you plus WESA reporters Katie Blackley and Sarah Schneider reported on a variety of strategies and programs. Tell us first about Malik Reed and his experience at Westinghouse High School.
Great, yeah. So Malik is a freshman at Westinghouse. He gets a free breakfast like most of the kids in the morning. So he'll have two muffins and an orange juice, which is really good. And then he says he's really not that picky, and like a lot of the students they found at Pittsburgh Public Schools. So are these kids who really need it, are they going to actually eat the food now that it's healthier? Right. Well, what we find from Malik and from students across the district is, yeah, he does eat it. He goes into the line. There's this new sriracha chicken. You know, it's a fun way they're trying to dress up the chicken. And he calls it chicken balls, but he eats it and he thinks it's delicious. Some of the nutrition requirements also force him to get a fruit or a vegetable now. So he has to get an applesauce. They turn him back if he doesn't get an applesauce in it. And they try and get him to take a healthier drink option, like a white milk as opposed to a chocolate milk. But they've had some limited success with that.
And you said requirements and all that. That's in order for the school districts to get their federal money, correct?
Yeah, to get the money. And so one of the things that also made a big difference is in 2014, 2015, districts like Pittsburgh that have a really high percentage of free and reduced students, they've been able to offer all of their students lunch for free. And so that they said that made a really big difference in order to, like, you know, partly discourage the stigma from getting school lunch and school breakfast, but also just makes it easier.
Yeah, and a lot about the school dietary guidelines have changed over the years. But it's a really careful blend of macronutrients, fat, calories, carbs, protein, to make sure that what kids are getting is a healthy blend, but also something that they will eat. Things like quinoa or falafel have been, sometimes they're into it and sometimes they're not.
Mount Lebanon was interesting because a lot of the students actually pay for their lunch there. And so one of the things they were able to do, they said, was offer more options because they were able to offer a lunch that costs a little bit more. And so because of that, they were able to do some fun things with their pizza, like put like Korean barbecue on their pizza.
Well, and, you know, as our colleague Sarah Schneider found, you can't really trick kids either. You can maybe sneak in a whole grain pizza crust, but you can't just sprinkle kale on top of it and hope for the best.
Okay, Virginia, a lot of need is just hunger, right? I mean, food insecurity is a symptom of something far bigger.
I mean, what we see is federal assistance has the most to offer. It has a lot more resources than like a community program like church meals or, you know, summer mealtime programs or something like that. But as we've seen, of course, there's a lot of barriers to that. So these smaller community-based programs like, you know, a food bank, well, they are a little bit volatile in what they can offer if one thing changes. And a lot of their food in Fayette County is sourced from the Greater Pittsburgh Community Food Bank. So they're like, you know, buying in a subsidized way or seeking donations from like larger organizations and things like that. Okay, let's say they're like one truck breaks down, or let's say that there's flooding in Fayette County and their freezers are down, which has happened more than one time. Well, then it's up to that community to really help itself. So maybe someone who would still be eligible for federal food assistance is actually the one who's like going and buying canned goods to donate to the food bank to give to those who have even less. And so it's a really volatile system where people, you know, it's it, yes, there's something larger at play. There's barriers, but it's also and that's why perspective matters so much. And recognizing that poverty is that people have to step up to keep these more immediate reactive systems in place and functioning.
And that's true of so many organizations. Of the 400 or so that are all combining to meet a collective need, a ton of them rely on these central organizations like the Greater Pittsburgh Community Food Bank or 412 Food Rescue. If anything happens with them or their sourcing, everyone feels the bump.
Or if there's one little change in like federal funding, everything just is a different game.
Okay, very briefly, and then we have left. What big questions do you still want to continue to explore regarding access to food? I'll start with you, Oliver.
I'm really interested in finding a school that is not just going to offer vegetables and different kinds of foods, but it's really going to try and hold themselves accountable to getting kids to eat it. I think it'd be really interesting to see, hey, we're not going to just give kids this option, but we're going to do everything we can and hold ourselves accountable to making sure that they actually choose these options and eat it.
Something we've looked for is solutions, but a lot of these programs are very small. Can they be scaled up? Will they be scaled up? And to who are they going to be scaled up for? Also, the intersection of these barriers. Again, just like a food desert in Pittsburgh is different than a food desert in Fayette County. Well, if you look at a more granular neighborhood-wide scale, how are the barriers that people are experiencing different based on racial intersections, socioeconomic intersections, and where they live?
And finally, Megan.
I'm really curious, especially regarding some of those differences in geography, how these individual organizations are coming together or not, or siloed, to meet a much smaller but not insignificant need.
And don't forget, check out all the stories at publicsource.org and WESA.FM. Oliver Morrison's environment and health reporter for Public Source, Virginia Alvino Young, and Megan Harris, our reporters at WESA. Thanks to all of you.
Thanks, Kevin. Thank you.
Are landowners in Pennsylvania getting their fair share for mineral rights from drilling companies? That's next on The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Katie Blackley with the Pittsburgh Almanac. This week in history, a series of bomb threats are sent to the University of Pittsburgh in 2012, prompting evacuations and class cancellations around campus for several weeks. One day in April, the school received a record 17 threats. Final exams were rescheduled, and the school changed its evacuation procedures. A Scottish man has since been charged in connection with the threats. That's this week's Pittsburgh Almanac for March 16, 2018.
It's The Confluence, where the news comes together. I'm Kevin Gavin. Lots of Pennsylvania landowners in recent years have let natural gas companies drill under their soil. Many hope to bring in some extra cash. So why are some striking it rich and others striking out? Joining us to talk about the royalties involved in those deals and how they're affecting the rest of us, State Impact reporters Marie Cusick, who's on the line from Harrisburg. Welcome back to the show, Marie.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
And in studio, Amy Sisk. Welcome to the program, Amy.
Hi. Glad to be here.
So let's start from the top here. What are natural gas royalties? How does the process work? I'll start with Amy.
Yeah, so when a company wants to drill for natural gas, they'll typically approach the person who owns the minerals underground in the spot where they want to drill. And typically that's the landowner that lives on top of that area. And the two sides will agree to a lease. And in that lease, in exchange for the natural gas company being able to drill in that location, the mineral owner will receive a certain percentage of the revenue that's generated from that natural gas well. And that percentage can be anywhere in Pennsylvania from a minimum of 12.5% to maybe 20-25% or so. And that's what the royalty is. And so that landowner will receive typically a monthly check with that royalty money.
Mm-hmm. Marie, that seems straightforward, but what's the stumbling block or what's at issue here?
Yeah, well, it's worth pointing out that a lot of people have made a lot of money this way. Gas companies have poured billions of dollars into royalty payments, so people have benefited greatly. What the problem has been, though, recently is there's a lot of controversy around deductions that gas companies take, and these are called post-production costs. So what they're essentially doing is saying, okay, you know, your royalty maybe was supposed to be $100 this month, but we're going to deduct $60 of it, and we're going to charge you, the mineral owner, for the expenses we incur as the gas company moving it from the well to the consumer. And with natural gas, there's a lot of expensive equipment like pipelines, dehydration equipment, things you have to do to process the gas. So people are concerned that these deductions often are not made in a transparent way, and sometimes they're saying they're getting very little money because so much is being deducted.
Okay, you use an important word there, transparent. So is there a vagueness, or is it the language is sort of murky, or is it a variable deduction?
It can be very murky. In some cases, this wasn't even contemplated in the lease. People weren't aware of it. They didn't even know about it. In other cases, they were aware of it, and they wrote leases saying, you can't deduct these expenses. Yet, in some cases, they're being deducted anyway. It's incredibly hard if you're a mineral owner, even if you hire an auditor, to try to figure out what all these costs are. And it can even be very hard to determine exactly how much gas is being produced, which is a sort of more fundamental question. So there's been a push in recent years. There's been bills introduced in Harrisburg to try to get more clarity and transparency around these costs and these deductions. But so far, not much has happened.
Amy?
Yeah, and I'll just add that it really all boils down to the specific language that is negotiated in a mineral owner's lease. And so some of those leases specifically outline which deductions can be taken. Other leases have kind of vague language and don't really address it, and other leases outright prohibit these deductions. And so that can just, a lot of issues can arise if gas companies take these deductions and the language is vague, or if the landowner believes in their lease that they have prohibited these deductions, but they're being taken anyway, that can lead to a lot of issues. And I'll add, too, that some landowners feel that the deductions that are taken out of their royalty checks are pretty reasonable. Other landowners feel that they're excessive, and that can give rise to a lot of litigation as well.
Speaking of litigation, Marie and Amy, do many of the people that you talk to, the mineral rights owners, do they have legal representation going into these contracts or not?
Sometimes they do, and sometimes they don't. And I think that over the years, so in Pennsylvania, there have been disputes over this issue for a number of years during the shale gas boom. And I think that landowners have become more educated over the years and know that they should get a lawyer to negotiate their lease for them. But I think especially early on in the shale boom, across the country, you would have companies approach landowners, and landowners would just sign the leases that were presented to them or wouldn't look through it carefully and try to negotiate a better deal.
All right, let's talk a little bit about money. I mean, really, how much are we talking about here? In your reporting, you introduce us to Charlie Clark. Let's hear from Charlie.
This is what we've done with our gas money. Was this, you know, this barn here costs $40,000 to build it, you know, and we were able to build it out of our pocket. And
well, if you didn't know you were in a barn, you heard evidence of that. Marie, how much is Charlie making? What has that money meant to Charlie and his family?
Yeah, he's a dairy farmer in Susquehanna County in the northeastern part of the state, and he is very happy with what he's receiving. He says it averages out to be about $10,000 a month in royalties from two wells that are on his property. So he's very pleased, and he's happy with the money he's receiving. He's been able to upgrade his farm, buy all kinds of new equipment. He told me he was taking a trip to go hunting in South Africa this summer. He loves to hunt. So he says, you know, he feels like he hit the lottery here, but he's very aware that not everyone has the same experience that he does. He says there are some deductions taken from his check, but he feels they're reasonable, but he has neighbors and people he knows who have what he considers to be and what they consider to be excessive deductions.
Does it come down to what company that you're dealing with, Amy?
You know, it can come down to what company you're dealing with, particularly in the northeastern part of the state, Chesapeake Energy. There have been a lot of lawsuits involving Chesapeake for taking excessive deductions. But it's not just an issue with Chesapeake. There's other gas companies that do this as well. And I can tell you that throughout the country, this is one issue that I've been looking at as to, you know, are other states dealing with similar issues as Pennsylvania? And the answer is yes. Particularly the past couple years, this issue has really spread to other oil and gas states across the nation. And what happened was the price of oil and the price of gas starting in 2014 really tanked. And when that happened, people's royalties, people just weren't receiving as many royalties as they used to because their oil and gas wasn't worth what it used to be. But at the same time, there still were those same transportation and treatment costs for that gas. And so that didn't change. And so that was taking up more and more of people's royalty checks. And so landowners started to notice were complaining more and more the past couple of years about these deductions.
All right. Now, Amy, how widespread are these deductions? Are they happening in other states as well?
Yeah, they're happening, I would say, in a number of oil and gas states across the country. There are some states where this isn't as big of an issue because there have been lawsuits in the past, and the courts in those states have actually ruled on the side of landowners. But in a lot of states, that's not the case. So you're seeing this pop up in North Dakota. You're seeing this pop up more in Texas and in other oil and gas states.
Marie, you report on another landowner who didn't have quite the experience that Charlie did. Jim Barrett, I believe, he filed a class action against Chesapeake Energy.
Yes, he's part of one of the class action lawsuits that are pending. And he will tell you that he's very happy the gas industry came to town, that it really helped revive the region and bring a lot of money in. And he actually has made quite a bit of money from the wells on his property. But at the same time, he feels he is owed, as he puts it, hundreds of thousands of dollars. And he feels that these deductions that, in this case, it's Chesapeake Energy, the company he's dealing with, he feels that they're excessive and inappropriate. I'll add that Chesapeake did decline to comment for our story. But, yeah, he's not happy. And it just the two men that we spoke to live 40 miles apart. They have very, you know, similar situations. And they're just having very different experiences with two different companies.
Amy, does any of this come down to landowner ignorance?
Yeah, I think that is an issue, that landowners are approached by these gas companies, and landowners obviously, you know, aren't in the oil and gas business. They might be farmers, they might be teachers, they might have any other job in the community. They're not experts in oil and gas, and so, you know, they don't have the expertise necessarily to look through a contract carefully and pinpoint, you know, where potential disputes could arise. And so that's been an issue with landowners not knowing that this is a potential thing that could happen to them.
We have just 2 minutes left. Pennsylvania has a minimum 12.5% royalty rate for mineral landowners, but in 2010, the state Supreme Court stuck with the courts, allowing companies to subtract from the royalties, even if that took these below the required 12.5%. Does that invalidate the law? And are landowners aware of the law or the Supreme Court decision made around it? Briefly, Marie.
Yeah, that 2010 case you brought up from the Pennsylvania Supreme Court, that was a really key ruling here, which basically said gas companies are allowed to take these deductions, and in some cases they do bring the royalty below that 12.5% floor. I think people are very aware of it at this point. If they've been dealing with these issues, people are upset about it, but that law requiring gas companies to pay 12.5%, it dates back to 1979. And there's a footnote in the court opinion that the mineral owners point to a lot, which says that essentially the word royalty in Pennsylvania is not very well defined, and that the legislature is the best body to better define it. So if you're talking about what your cut is supposed to be, you're supposed to get 12.5%. 12.5% of what? You know, where is it sold, and are you going to deduct these costs of moving it, et cetera? So there's been a lot of different bills that have been introduced, as I mentioned, in Harrisburg, but nothing's really moved forward.
Okay, we have just 30 seconds left. Each of you, very briefly, what will you continue to follow regarding this story about mineral rights? Very briefly, Marie.
Well, we're just going to keep following any of the legislation that's proposed and see what advocates and what the industry, how they're trying to resolve these issues.
All right. And Amy?
Yeah, and I'll add that in West Virginia, just about a week ago, the governor signed a bill into law addressing this specific issue and actually prohibiting some of these deductions for certain types of leases. So I'll be looking at that.
Amy Sisk and Marie Cusick are reporters for State Impact Pennsylvania, a reporting collaboration among public media stations WITF, WHYY, WESA, and the Allegheny Front. Amy, Marie, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And for this week, that's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. The engineer for our program is Tom Hurley. Research and production assistance from Zakiya Madian. The producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good week of good news.